So, moving along, we come to Seroth.
Ah, yes, Seroth. Ah, oh, Seroth.
And I got an amazing kick early in her point of view out of her piecing together the Damani going missing and the Soldam, whose secret she knows, going missing, and Tuan going missing, and she puts them all together in this gigantic, elaborate scheme that somebody's trying to assassinate Tuan to throw off the return, and this huge plan. She overlooks the fact completely that Matt was ever there at all, and the relatively simple explanation, which actually happens to be the truth. I mean, all this happenstance just all happened at once, and she turned it into this gigantically overblown plot to, like, throw off everything that the Shanshan are trying to do with the return.
Somebody is trying to overthrow the return and kill Tuan Semirog.
I think that's just, a very strong indicator of how completely whacked the dark side of the Shanshan Empire is. Because their power struggles are these huge, elaborate plots that require all sorts of things that could be happenstance, but probably aren't, because they are part of this huge, elaborate plot. And so that's how Seroth thinks, because that's how the nobility, the imperial power mongering works in Shanshan. But that's not the way it works over on this side of the ocean. Things just happen. People who want power will go and kill somebody and take it, rather than trying to set it up so that the person becomes Doc Colville. And I think it's really cool how you mentioned she overlooked Matt. That's one of the nice things Tylin did for him by naming him her toy. She made him expendable. She made him something that Seroth wouldn't even think of because, heck, he's property. Who would ever think of him capable of performing these extravagant feats?
Well, actually, she told Seroth and Tuan that Matt was not property when Tuan tried to buy him.
And she believed that about not at all, probably. Yeah, but I love this other point. She kind of thinks about it, that the Ath and Mir have gotten free of their Adam, and no one, and she thinks specifically no one but a Soldam knows how to unclasp that. And I think that's just hilarious that she's so sure of all these traditions she's grown up with that she doesn't think anyone else can figure out how the Adam works.
Well, I think she's kind of a product of her culture, because unfortunately really rigid caste-like cultures like that tend to not reward creative thinkers, and even though she's a very powerful dark friend and has risen high in society for her, she's not the brightest light on the tree. She thinks, she's just swallowed the Kool-Aid. She thinks that only a Soldam can open a Damani's item, and that's it. I mean, she doesn't think outside the box very much. She's just, in fact, when Semirog comes to her and says, I want you to be the Empress, she goes, oh no, if I claim to be the Empress, I'll be killed by slow torture over 10 days or whatever. But she's just like, she can't even conceive of just taking to one's place. It's just so ingrained to be the way they are and to fit in and be what they are. It's kind of scary in a world, but I think that Seroth is just, she's a very powerful dunderhead, in my opinion.
Yeah, and one of the other things, she's thinking to herself, maybe I can find another Anath on Shadar to, do stuff for me. And then she makes a comment, and that was never an easy task. Relatively few Soldam turned to the Great Lord, oddly. And to me, oddly is really right. I mean, I don't know how much we can trust what Seroth knows about Dark Friends, but it kind of got me thinking, well, maybe there's a reason that not a lot of Soldam are turned to the Great Lord. They are in a constant state of pseudo-linkage with their Damani. Now, granted, I guess it wouldn't occur to them to try to use the 13-13 combo on the Soldam, because the Soldam are supposedly not channelers. But, I'm not wondering if maybe being linked Soldam to Damani, if there isn't some sort of weird protection that is coffered against becoming a Dark Friend. I don't know. I mean, I kind of have to tincture that against, yes, the Soldam are very duty-oriented, but so is Ingtar. And Ingtar turned to the Shadow because of his duty, you know, in guarding the Blight.
I think you're kind of... I think the link might have a major part to do with it. And not the linking itself, not the linkage, but the actual fact that the two women are linked together. They share pretty much intimately their minds. And it would be very difficult, at least in my opinion, I think it would be very difficult for Sol Dahm to hide the fact that she is a dark friend from this Damani. And then the next person who comes along to use this Damani can see, oh, there's something wrong with this other Sol Dahm. We need to take a look at this. But also, I'm kind of wondering if maybe the fact that one can channel is perhaps a buffer against the Dark One. Because if we think about it, I know that the Black Ajah seem like this big, huge threat, but if we think about it, how much of the actual Aes Sedai population does it make up? You look at the other channeling nations in the world as we know it. How many of these people are actually dark friends that we know of? It could be that somehow the ability to channel is a buffer against this, and it might just be the females, because we know the Ashaman have major dark friend issues going along in their ranks.
Well, they had the tank going on, too. I mean, but you remember, Moraine actually said that in the beginning of the world. She said that being in proximity to an Aes Sedai provided them some protection from, you know, the Dark One and the Shadow Spawn and so forth. Just actually being in proximity to an Aes Sedai. Think about that. They haven't really talked about that much since then, but Moraine said it, so it has to be true. If Moraine said it, it's true.
Kind of like Varen said it, it's true, but then we have a conflict of interest there.
Well, I love Varen, so she said it is true for me. I'm going to be really, really upset if Varen turns out to be a dark friend. I mean, really upset.
Just remember, in this instance, 1 + 1 = cow.
Okay.
Yeah, I honestly hold with the idea that there is some massive organizational group among those who are 100% dedicated to the light rather than their own ends.
The Purple Aja. We talked about that before. Well, let's not get off on Varen. Let's go back to our prologue here.
Yeah, there was an interesting thing that got mentioned. Sarath is, again, she's in her meeting with General Galgan, and she makes mention about... There's mention going back and forth about whether or not they're ready to move on Ilion after Altara and Taraban are settled, or even now while Altara and Taraban aren't settled. And it just, you know, the thought immediately struck me. Ilion is where the Horn is supposed to eventually show up for some reason that's never been clearly defined. You know, Ilion has these places. I mean, Rand is currently king there. It seemed really weird. It's like, would it be natural that the Shanshan would immediately take Ilion next? It just seemed really interesting that Ilion showed up as the next target, and it was verified as their next line of attack as the return progresses. And I just thought that was really interesting, and it might possibly have something to do with the fact that the horn of Valyr is tied to Ilion somehow.
That's very possible, because Tuon was very concerned with finding the person that sounded the horn. But I actually, looking at the map, think that it's just a geographical thing. They seem to just be working their way along the coast in both directions from the two cities that they landed in. And Ilion's right next door to Amadisia, so there you go. And there is that mountain range that separates all those coastal lands from, you know, the two rivers, which is actually geographically really pretty close to, to some other major areas, such as Eridomon and Taraban and stuff like that. But it's on the other side of these mountains, so no one ever goes there from that direction. And the same thing, you know, what was it, the Demonas or whatever, the Demona Mountains? They're just kind of working their way along the coast, as far as I can tell, geographically.
I think there's a lot of credence to Andrew's observation here, because we don't know why the horn has to be an Ilion. The first thing that Moraine said when they found it, this has to be taken to Ilion, and that's nothing that's ever been clarified. Why does it need to be there? We don't know where Suon hid it. We assume that it was in the tower or maybe in Tar Valon, but she had the power to literally hide it anywhere she wanted in Randland. She had people that she could send to hide it any place she wanted. I doubt she did. It's still much more likely that it's somewhere inside Tarbalon.
No, I think she had Varen. But I think she had Varen hide it, and I think that's where Varen's gone off to go get the horn, because Matt needs it.
Yeah. I think that the reason that the Seanchan believe they're attacking Illion is that it's right next door, it's the next logical step. But I think there's a bigger reason why they are right next door to Illion, and it's their next logical step, than just that's the way that the return's been progressing.
Okay, well, answer me this. How do the Seanchan, who have been isolated from Randland for thousands of years, how do they know that the horn is tied to Illion? I believe that's a relatively recent event, the horn of the hunt for the horn being called in Illion. Where does it say in the prophecies that the horn's going to be in Illion? And do they even have the same prophecies over there in Shandar? We know they're different. So how do they even know that the horn's tied to Illion?
Well, I don't think the argument here is that the Seanchan know anything about the horn in Illion. I don't think the Seanchan are looking for any reason. Maybe Soroth is. Maybe under the direction of Semrog, Soroth knows why that they need to attack Illion next, and she might just equate it to the fact that the Dragon Reborn is king there. But I think that there are larger forces at work here than just common... Well, we know there's larger forces at work in the world than just common logic, but I think in this specific instance, we can really see those things working, setting up events I don't know even how many months in advance, probably close to a year in advance, so that they would have to come this way and progress through Illion.
I don't know. I guess we'll have to just raffle that one. We'll read and find out. I think the next interesting point that you bring up is, where has Duhara gone?
At the meeting where Tsutsama is talking with Pavara and Javendra, we do know, she mentions that Duhara is gone and that she disappears. Obviously, we know that Duhara has left in order to try to secure a position as Elaine's advisor in Camelon.
Yes, score!
I did not catch that yet.
All evening, not remembering a single name first time I tried. So we don't know if Javendra's a dark friend. You bring up the point that Javendra hides a smile in her teacup when Tsutsama, that's a terrible name, Tsutsama, suggests that Elida not be apprised of bonding the Ashaman.
What horrible parents sending their children that.
Yeah, for some reason, it was just, we just won't tell Elida. And it made a very specific point of saying, that Pavara was watching Javendra and that she hid a smile in her tea. And she kind of remarks that, what does she have to smile about? And it occurs to me, it's like, that does seem really, really odd. Why would she be smiling over, let's just not tell Elida about it?
Oh, I'm just going to go with the obvious choice. I think of that so many Aes Sedai, even in the Red, are so tired of Elida's mismanagement, heavy-handedness, random penances and rantings, that any little way to get back at her or thwart her is a pleasure.
And here I thought the obvious choice was that she was of the Black Aja, but I think that's too obvious for RJ's purposes.
And I think if she were a Black Aja, she'd be better at hiding her feelings and stuff, too. They're pretty devious. I don't think they'd be such bad actors if that were the cause. I mean, I'm not ruling out that she might be a dark friend. I happen to agree with whoever it was that said, if you want to find dark friends, look in the Red Aja. I think that's it's not going to be far from the truth, especially since the former head of the Reds was Kalina, dark friend, not anymore par excellence.
True. And like I said, there wasn't a whole lot in the Pavara point of view that I really brought out that didn't seem to be kind of cut and dry and very, I'm giving you this information, it is straight up, directly, and quite obvious. A little more, though, with Alvieran. She has a place where she's thinking, every night she dreamed of killing Mesaana, often daydreamed of how to manage it successfully, yet that must wait on finding her without the woman knowing herself found. And the question that immediately pops in my head is, how is that even possible? Because Mesaana knows that Alvieran knows who she's been masquerading as. When the uber illusion was shattered by Shadar Haran, you know, the first thing that Alvieran says or thinks was that, you know, she recognized the face that she saw there. So how can you possibly catch her without her knowing that she's been found?
Well, just because,
if she knows that you know what she looks like.
Well, just because somebody knows who you are, your enemy knows who you are, doesn't mean that they, and you know who they are, doesn't mean that they can't sneak up on you. I think she just was referring to the fact that she needed to come on her when she was unawares and do something to her, you know, before she could react. Maybe that's the mundane, obvious choice again, but I didn't read anything particularly revealing into that, other than the fact that, I mean, if you were under Masana's thumb, who wouldn't dream of killing Mesaana? Oh. I wanted to kill her, and I'm just the gentle reader.
Yeah, I just, for some reason, I found the way it was phrased in her point of view to be a little prosy. I mean, like, excessively so, in my mind. You know, the idea of, you know, but that must wait on, you know, coming upon her unawares also fulfills the same concept, and in my mind was a little clearer as to the meaning. I don't know, maybe I just read a little too much into it.
I have to disagree with both of you. I don't think that she actually saw the face that Mesaana was masquerading as. Because Mesaana is masquerading as an Aes Sedai. That means she had to replace somebody, which means she has to look like that somebody. She can't just suddenly, oh, there's a new Aes Sedai that we've never ever seen before. That doesn't make any sense. So when the Mask of Illusion or the Mask of Mirrors or whatever they call the silly thing was shattered by Shadar Haran's appearance, I remember her noting that she recognized the dress and she recognized the face, but the face was the face of Mesaana, not the face of the Aes Sedai that she has taken the place of. It's not the face of the sister that Alvieran would recognize.
See, the thing is that I guess I've always assumed that Mesaana chose someone who hadn't been in the tower for an extremely long period of time, so that it is possible, like, a lot of people wouldn't know what Kudzwane looked like in the tower. It might just have been possible that she had decided to adopt an identity where she wouldn't have been recognized using her own face. Like I said, that's probably a little far-fetched considering how long Aes Sedai live, but that, I guess, was my original thinking behind it.
Well, that's why I've always sort of done the obvious, picked on Danielle, the brown, the dreamy brown, who was a solitary, who had no friends, basically. I mean, that's the kind of person you're going to want to pick to impersonate, not somebody with a wide and active social circle going on around them. But Alvieran knows Mesaana's true face. She doesn't know necessarily the face of the Aes Sedai she's masquerading as, but knowing Mesaana's true face is also a danger, because now if she ever runs into her when she's not wearing the Mask of Mirrors, she'll know exactly who she is rather than just some random person who might be walking around the White Tower like Lanfear did.
Yeah, that is definitely true. The next point I had thought about with Alvieran is she's writing her orders to bring Talene back and to put a close watch on Yukiri and the others. She catches upon, quicker than Seraph, Alvieran is, she actually catches upon the fact that Talene has to have found a way beyond her oaths to the Black Asha. And, you know, I think it puts her dangerously close to figuring out that someone is looking and trying to hunt down the Black Aja.
Well, you know, as kind of the surrogate leader of the Black Aja, she would know that the oaths on the oath rod could be removed. But, yeah, she's definitely much more intelligent than Seraph in matters of this type, where extraordinary and strange, unusual, not necessarily extraordinary, but unusual things are happening around her, and so she kind of says, well, I know that this, this, and this are all possible, so what if they all happened, or this, this, or this?
Right, that's pretty much all I had in the Elvriarin section. So as we climb our way into the Galena section, we get a musing, as Galena is constantly thinking about the rod that Therava has and, you know, how to remove her restriction against obeying Therava. I couldn't help but notice the phrase, "Perhaps the oath rod in the tower could lift that oath from her, as well as the nearly identical rod in Therva's possession. Yet she could not be sure." And as you said earlier, Virginia, RJ said absolutely nothing in these books without a reason. And we've talked about the fabled Nine Rods of Dominion, and we never really got a description of what they were, or what they did, or, you know, whether or not they could affect each other, or whether they had a reciprocal relationship with one another. And I just kind of imagine that there's going to be a scramble at some point in time where more than one person is going to have a quote-unquote oath rod, and they're going to kind of go back and forth with this sort of, you know, dueling banjos kind of thing. It will not make a weapon for one man to kill another.
Dueling oath rods, so why would they need to duel? I don't think they need to actually have dueling oath rods. I think they could easily be the Nine Rods of Dominion. After all, there's nothing more dominating than binding somebody to do one thing or another so that it's basically etched in their bones, you know. So perhaps that is the case. They really don't tell us much about the Nine Rods of Dominion. I think you bring up another point, too, that that bleakness was also used to describe Galena's state after Therava gets done with her, but ironically, that's an Aiel reference. I mean, she's absorbing some more Aiel ways than she thinks, which is probably good, because she's going to be spending a long time with him, it looks like.
I think the counter-argument to the Oath Rods being the Nine Rods of Dominion is the numbers that are engraved into the side. Of course, those numbers could mean any number, any multitudes of things. They could not even relate to the amount of oath rods in existence. Am I the only one who, when he said dueling oath rods, got a picture of two Aes Sedai or other women in their big fluffy dresses fighting with the oath rods as swords? I don't know.
Like lightsabers. Oh no, that was the rod that produced Balefire. Never mind.
No, you mean Mace Windu's Rod of Dominion.
That's the one. Yeah, no, I don't know. Yeah, having the numbers engraved on them is definitely a negative toward the theory of them being the Nine Rods of Dominion. Unless they were originally a lot more than nine and they just winnered it down to nine over the Age of Legends, I don't know. I thought I had a great theory there. Thanks a lot. Shot it down.
Of course, we don't know that the numbers actually mean what they mean either. It's kind of trails back to that idea that, you know, certain Norse runes represented both ideas and numbers. And, it, you know, it's not like they actually just have, you know, a 1 and a 4 written on it. I mean, it's, if I remember properly, it's written in the Old Tongue. And, you know, they don't completely understand all the intricacies of the Old Tongue. No one really does, because it's so
old.
Complex.
And old. And if you cross me again, it's the oath rod for you, bucko.
Yeah, that was one of the points I was going to bring up. We know the Aes Sedai aren't infallible. We know that their supposed intelligence isn't. We know that quite often they are incorrect. More often than they aren't, sometimes. And so the Nine Rods of Dominion is a very likely situation. Or it could just be that he summoned nine... It could just be that he summoned 900 Rods of Dominion rather than just 9, but they dropped 100 because it just didn't roll off the tongue as easily.
Or there were 100 of them, but there were only 9 really powerful ones. I mean, maybe there were some better than others. I don't know.
Or maybe it's binary.
Oh, God. I do think they said something about, oh, now you're going to go look it up in one of the, you know, the ninth repository or whatever, where they keep all the books on various forms of arithmetic. I'm going, oh, great. What we need in this book is another form of arithmetic besides base 10. Thank you.
Well, here's a question, though, is what does it mean to summon the Nine Rods of Dominion? It could very easily mean that there were hundreds of these rods, but like you said, there was 9 that were more powerful, and he had the power to say, I want those people who are in charge of those 9 rods to come to me now, because I need the power of those rods. I need to use that.
One ring to rule them all, one ring to bind them. Oh, maybe there were actually, you know, many, many rods, but there were some that had dominion over the others. Ah! What a concept.
You know, it does say that they were chained like criminals, and why wouldn't those chains have the power to get those criminals, those people who are bound, to do what they're supposed to do without, you know, obviously they have the oaths laying on them, they can't break those oaths. But if you have the 9 rods of dominion and they dominate over the other rods, maybe they have a power over those people who have the... it's like some form of mega compulsion. I don't know.
Oh, I think I'm going to call a Rafo on this one and move on in the interest of time.
Yeah. The next point that I was going to bring up was mentioning the conversation that Galena overhears when she's first brought into Perrin's tent. They interrupt a man saying, and I had to have to assume this was the Ashaman who was in the tent speaking to Perrin. He begins mid sentence, said he was all or he was ready to come right now. A man was saying, I can't afford to feed one more mouth when I don't know for how long. Another man replied, Blood and ashes, how long does it take to arrange a meeting with these people? She seems cautious, Perrin, Berlaine then says. Which she is she talking about? In my mind, is Perrin trying to get in touch with Seroth, or is he trying to get in touch with Tuan? I just sheerly don't remember at this point. And the thing is, whoever she is, she seems cautious. But from everything we've seen out of the Shanshan so far, if a person is eager to work with the Shanshan, or at least willing to work with the Shanshan, the Shanshan are all over them, like, you know, ducks on beetles. And I just, you know, it seemed really weird that they would be, whoever this person is showing hesitation at meeting with Perrin, who is seeming to offer an alliance that would benefit the Shanshan. I'm also kind of interested into who he was that is ready to come right now.
It sounds to me, not that they're referring to Seroth or Tuon, but to the two leaders of the Shanshan army that they're going to meet in the next couple chapters. I don't remember which chapter it is.
Yeah, Mishima and Banner General Pele Kurgan, I think.
Yeah, and it sounds to me like the he who is ready to come right now could easily be the underling, and the she who is cautious is the Banner General. And if you think about it, no one else that they've really made a strong compact with has openly yet had Ashaman and Aes Sedai and other channelers serving underneath them. And with their views on Mereth Damani, and especially the worldview on the Ashaman, it really hasn't been that many books since the taint was cleaned. With the worldview on men who can channel, that she has every right to be cautious.
Well, and they were clearly fearing a trap of some sort.
Yeah, true. I can definitely see that now that you mention it.
Especially if, like you're saying, it's the Ashaman talking at first. He seems ready to go right now. That means that he had actually been there and talking with them and seeing them and communicating with them, which means a gateway. So he would have been very blatant about his use of the One Power.
Oh, I don't know. It was Talonvor that offered to set this up, and he didn't have access to a gateway. I think he just found them in the vicinity. I don't think there was any need for gateways to make the initial contact from what Talonvor said.
Well, now here's an idea. I had forgotten about Talonvor. It could be that Talonvor is the he who's ready to come right now, but it is the Ashaman who's talking, and the Ashaman, when they don't have to, they don't walk farther than they have to, and the gateway is a perfect way to get from one place to another.
I just think it was the two Shanshan officers that were just reluctant. You know, he was less reluctant than she was, but I think they were just being cautious. I don't know if we can really read that much more into this particular scene than we have.
True. No, I just wanted to say that on page 79 of the hardcover of the text, I just have to give a little bit of credit to RJ for having Perrin use the phrase, if I had my druthers, I'd be attacking right now. Kudos for the use of an obscure and old-timey phrase.
Okay, so we find out in the next point that you bring up that the Wise Ones are trying to crack down on the Shido's drinking habits. smart move, though ineffective. And you think they're expecting the drinking to affect the Aiel combat performance with their propensity for drinking Usquai? Well, yeah, obviously, I think that's what's happening.
See, but that just seems to make a little sense. I mean, we've seen the Aiel drinking in a number of scenes, and like I said, it's usually like Usquai. Yet they've got like, oh, we found this wine here in this town, and they're worried about the wine affecting how they fight? I mean, come on, they're drinking whiskey for crying out loud.
Yeah, but they might be running short of the Usquai, and they've got the wine right to hand, so they're supping it up.
I honestly don't know the effects of different alcohols. It's not something I have any personal experience with, nor plan to in the near future. But could it be that they have become accustomed to the Usquai, which really is a strong drink, but they aren't accustomed to the effects of the wine, and so the wine is affecting them differently than the Usquai does?
I don't know. I think it all just goes back to the fact that all of the Aiel that we've really met so far are really disciplined, and I can't think of the word I'm looking for, but they're all very stern and disciplined in their habits and so forth and so on, except for the Shido, and almost uniformly all the other clans and societies among the Aiel look down on the Shido. And I just think that this is just one more symptom of it. They are definitely looked down, and it's kind of almost a lesser, not breed, but you know, a lesser group of people. And they don't like it. I mean, even the Brotherless are ready to leave them. The Shido's habits sicken them. They're doing all these things against, you know, Jia To, and they're just like, you know, we're not going to stay with these people anymore, no matter who the Karakaran is.
Yeah, and we know from Fail's point of view, and I think Chapter 4, that they do get drunk enough to assault the Gai Shain, which is so against tradition that to be the... It was punished by death in one instance.
Yeah, it's pretty reprehensible
behavior.
That's
a very good point.
I love this next scene where Galena's in the tent and she's trying to gather together her alibi for being late for Thurava, because she's pretty sure she's going to be late when they take her back. And Berylaine says, I do not believe he will hit Galena. And so she glides forward with her skirts gathered. He has fairy country ways. What is that supposed to mean? And then that's right after, right before she slugs her one. I don't know. Personally, I don't make too much out of the country ways. I think that she just kind of looked down at it. I don't think that everywhere in Ranland it was improper for a man to harm a woman for any reason. I think it was really ingrained in the societies that came down from Manetherin. It's really ingrained in the borderlands, but I don't think in Ilion or Murundi or Tyr or any of those things it's such a big deal as it is, you know, among certain of the societies, and it is more of a countryman's way to be more conservative and maybe traditional and stuff like that. So I'm just going to come down on the side of not reading too much into that too.
Well, it reads more to me kind of like Berylaine taking a poke at Perrin. Just he has very country ways. He's not going to break them, because she has been trying pretty much since the fourth book to get him to break his country ways.
Yeah, he's a prude.
She's kind of shoved over a bit since Fail went missing, and he's gone absolutely insane, literally, trying to get her back. But it just kind of feels like she's poking a little bit of fun at Perrin there.
Yeah, I sort of felt it was like Min calling Rand a countryman or a hay hare, and how Fail always poked fun at Perrin, calling him blacksmith and, you know, country boy and all this stuff. I think it's just sort of the sophisticate sort of taking a little jab at the country boy.
Yeah, I suppose so. It just kind of seemed like, oh, he has very country ways. And it's like, really? Seriously? That's how you're going to explain his reluctance to hit someone?
Yeah. Well, I think it just makes it obvious that those aren't the norm in Rand Land. That's a pretty provincial outlook.
Well, if you think about it, I don't think anyone, except maybe the Ashaman, any of the other men in that tent would have been willing to hit her. Just because, well, some of them are afraid because she's Aes Sedai. Others, she's a female. She's a woman. You do not harm women when you have any other opportunity. But still, it is, I love it, just Decker, boom. Now on the other side, boom. Aha.
Yeah, I, on the other hand, would have had to, would have fought you for the privilege of hitting her had I been there, because Galena is one of my very least favorite characters in the book. I was glad when she got hit. I wish she'd hit her more, and I wish the Rava would be even harder on her, if that's possible. I would have been like cooking her over the brazier, you know, in a bag of herbs. And like, oh my goodness, there's just nothing you could do to that woman that would be bad enough, I don't think. Ugh, I hated her.
I'm going to have to disagree with you there. There are certain lines that shouldn't be crossed. And the stripping someone so bad that you can no longer hit them any place except the soles of their feet, I think is way far over that line. But that's my own opinion.
She's a dark friend, and she's Red Aja, and she's obnoxious. That's enough.
She's still human, and she still feels pain. She still has emotions as much as she tries to deny the fact. I guess I empathize too easily with the characters in any given book that I happen to be reading. I can't even read Dumai's Wells anymore because I'm afraid that I'll actually go insane and kill somebody.
Don't do that. Don't do that. No, I'm sorry. I can't drum up a lot of sympathy for some of these people like Alina and Alviar and Siroth and stuff like that. You know, do whatever you want to them. I don't care. And Elida, too. I mean, I'm sort of like Tuon, you know, where she comes up with when she slaps the item on the three Aes Sedai, Jolene, Asina, and Teslin, and Matt's trying to convince her to take them off. And she just stands there and she goes, "They have annoyed me, Toy." Oh, that's enough. They annoyed me to the point where I don't care what anybody does to him anymore. Yeah.
And see, the only one I feel deserved that fate was Jolina, because she hadn't had it before, and she hadn't... I really don't think Teslin deserved it. I kind of like her, but we'll get into that later. But, yeah, I really think, personally, in my opinion, it's better just to kill them and have done with it.
Well, had I been Matt, I think I would have done as he was tempted sorely to do, and let Tuon have Jolene for a few days and teach her a few what-fors, just because she so richly deserved it. But, yeah, Teslin, that was a little overkill. She was really almost broken by her experience. And Edesina, not nearly as much, but she wasn't as obnoxious, so that's okay. And that was starting to sound like Andrew Miller. Oh, he was always, you know, just ready to do anything to some of these people he didn't like, but... Maybe not quite anything, but I think if I'd have been Matt, I'd have let Duan have Jolene for a while. She really deserved that. 22 seconds was not enough to be collared for her.
Yeah, maybe we should save this until we reach that part in the story, though.
Okay.
Probably so. So this leaves us with only one point of view left, that being Egwene's point of view, and yay! The very first thing I have to say, one of the first Egwene notices as they are in the carriage traveling toward the White Tower, is that there is garbage in the streets of Tarvalon. You know, the city has started to grow filthy, and I completely agree 100% with Egwene. Yes, Elida should be pulled down. You're in a time of war, and the place that you are commanding from is turning into a cesspit? Hello, you are a terrible leader. You need to leave.
How much of that, though, can you blame on Mordeth and Padan Thane, whatever he's become, the influence of that spirit, ghost, power, force, destructive, evil thing?
Well, I've got to say, far be it from me to defend Elida, one of my least favorite characters, and I have said before that I think that she is so arrogant, ignorant, and stupid that she might as well be a dark friend, because everything she does basically is pretty much what a dark friend would do. But in Elida's defense, it comes out later in the book, spoiler warning, that the reason that the streets are not being cleaned and they have not had any luck getting anybody to clean the streets is because the dead are walking and people are afraid to come out of their homes. And, you know, Elida's basically reduced to trying to get the tower guard and whoever else she can get that's really totally under her command and maybe a little bit more, you know, stiff-spined than the average citizen, to go clean that garbage and stuff like that, because the general populace who are in charge of doing that stuff mostly, garbage cleaners won't come out because the dead are walking, hello? That's pretty scary to most people. The Aes Sedai aren't too offended or affected by it, but the average person, yeah, they're going to really be taken aback.
Oh, yeah. See, that's the problem with being in charge of the early portions of a book, is that unless you have specific memory of the first or last time that you read the book... You tend to forget little things like that detail that you just mentioned.
Well, except some of us brown Aja who have the most amazing trivia rattling around in our heads. I'm not brown, but I would be green if I could, but I'm not.
I think you'd fit into the brown just a bit easier than the green. I don't know.
I'll be a bookish green. I'm all about those Baird swords on the wall, honey.
Yeah, one of the other things interesting in that particular carriage ride, one of the reds, I want to say, taunts the gray sister who's in the carriage. And she says, in some instances, the chair of pardon faced the same penalty as the one she defended. And, you know, I gotta wonder, what's the point of that? Yes, we're assigning you this attorney. She's absolutely great, but if you lose, she gets 15 to 20 years, too.
Yeah, I've never understood that. I think that's one of the most absurd things I've ever heard in my life. Nobody would ever volunteer for the chair of pardon, and how could you just assign somebody to it if they didn't believe in the cause? And, you know, I don't know, that whole thing seems a little screwy to me. I'm not sure if that's just not, I don't know, a momentary lapse of reason or something on the point of RJ. I don't know. It makes no sense to me.
I want to be stilled. I want to be stilled. Makes sense.
Yeah, birched. I want to be birched. Please, let me be birched.
I was just saying that they are Aes Sedai. It doesn't have to make any form of sense. They'll just do whatever the heck they want and say, we know better than you because we can channel the One Power, so there.
No, they're very organized in their own way. They just get really hidebound and traditionalized and believe a lot of things are because they've always been that way, and they kind of forget to look outside the box. You know, you got to have somebody that's only half trained, like the Wonder Girls running around with a lot of power, that just says, hey, I think I'm just going to do it this way. Ha-ha! Yay! Oh, it worked! Look, I didn't get burned out!
Yeah, that's... Suan Sanche, she's one of the characters that I really like. She's done a lot of good things. There were a lot of stupid things that she did, but she's done a lot of good things. And I think her practically just very subtly influencing the small hall of the tower, whomever, and the little group that was actually leading the Rebel Aes Sedai, to choose Egwene as the Amyrlin, someone who didn't have the stuffy, scary, tradition, high-bound upbringing that the other Aes Sedai had, someone who had a worldview that was different than, we're high and mighty, we know what's right, our traditions are infallible. Someone who had seen those traditions fail, someone who had seen other things work better, was one of her better things that she ever did. That and sending them away so that they didn't get the formal training.
I think that was really only sort of a side effect of, I don't think she didn't want them to necessarily have the formal training. I think she was just desperate and needed them where they were, so she did what she could do.
That still doesn't explain the chair of pardon, though. I mean, who the heck?
I don't know. I don't know. Unless RJ comes down in that proverbial column of white light, we're probably never going to know.
Now, as we continue on, Egwene notices so many instances of the infighting within the White Tower, you know, Aja's threatening one another, you know, open hostilities all over the place, women, you know, going everywhere surrounded in a nimbus of light. You know, it only confirms for me that the taint of Eridol is consuming Tarvalon. It is absolutely, completely evident. And I kind of had to wonder, what happens if Rand finally comes to the White Tower? You know, would because he could, you know, sense the, he could sense the taint of Eridol when he was in it, you know, kind of pulsing against it, or against the taint of the Dark One. And I'm not wondering if he wouldn't kind of recognize Eridol's taint again. You know, maybe the reason his wounds aren't healing, and this falls into crazy theory land, what happens if, you know, the taint could be cleansed from Tarvalon as well? You know, maybe you have to get rid of all of the major sources of the taint before the wounds in his side could actually be healed. Now, of course, I doubt that's actually ever going to happen or that we would get an answer to that question, but, you know, it's an interesting thought in my mind.
I got to kind of question that a little bit. I actually, Fane was not in Tarvalon that long, and he's long since left on his hunt for Rand. And I do think that Elida shows signs of being brushed with the taint, but I'm not sure how much she absorbed that she could be contaminating the entire White Tower and city of Tarvalon. I think all of the dissension And, you know, the insanity is basically because Alviarin and some of the other Black Aja were specifically given orders by several of the Chosen and the Forsaken that we know about, including Masana. And they mentioned this at one of their little tea parties that, you know, you need to have them sow more dissension in the White Tower. I want these Aes Sedai hating each other's in their blood. The whole point of Alviarin's mission was to give Elida these orders that set the Ajahs at each other's throat and basically all the sisters, you know, contending with one another. And the whole point is chaos and to split one of the most powerful of all the possible opponents of the Dark Lord. So maybe the Taint of Eridol has some effect in there, but I don't think that that's the major cause of it. As far as the cleansing of the wounds, that's a whole other issue. Maybe because the dagger still exists, that still has some effect on the taint on Rand's wounds. I don't know. That's a good point. I like that.
I don't know. It is kind of interesting when you think about it. And I'm going to argue the flip side here again, Virginia. Because it seems to me that Ordeath, the amalgamation of Mordeath and Padon Fain, that Ordeath had Alviarin in his power for, I think, long enough to plant the seed of this idea, which is also expounded upon by the Forsaken. And so she takes it to Elida, and they're sure they have their own selves pulling each other apart. And I think in this environment, the Taint of Eridol is just running wild and free. This is exactly the kind of environment it needs to thrive and survive. And so he may not have been there that long, and he may not have left much of the taint behind. But I think with the way that the Aes Sedai started treating each other on their own, the taint has grown more powerful and stronger and is keeping it going. Because otherwise, those people who were smart enough to say, this isn't right, we need to stop this, would be able to stop it. They are powerful and they're sitters. They have a loud enough voice that they could say, "What? Take a look at yourselves, this is wrong." But they don't, because they're suspicious and afraid and all these other things that are specifically attributed to the Taint of Eridol.
I'm going to disagree with you a little bit there. I think that there's something in what you say, but there are plenty of the sitters that are in Tarvalen, like Yukiri, who reflected specifically in one of her points of view that if they didn't stop fighting with each other, it was like, she said it was like if they were like fighting over Aunt Yuki's pewterware while the robbers are coming in and taking everything else, that if they didn't stop this dissension among everybody in the White Tower, that they were basically going to hand the whole thing over to the rebels on a silver platter. And several of the sitters that are, you know, in Pavara's little group have definitely, in their points of view mentally, expressed that opinion. So I think that the reason that more of them aren't doing anything about it is because Elida is the Ammerlin seat. She rules over all of them with an iron hand. Her keeper is a dark friend who implements and basically directs Elida what to say and what to do on Masana's direct orders. And I think that they, even though they're sitters, they have relatively little power over Elida at this point in the history of the White Tower. I mean, other than rising up and pulling her down the way she pulled down Swan Sanche, there's not a lot they can do except to try and block as many as the things as they can. Unfortunately, a lot of people, even Aes Sedai, are small and petty and leaped onto some of these, you know, little privileges, like, you know, wailing on anybody who strayed into the wrong Aja quarters, et cetera, et cetera. And that may be part of the taint, that may be just, you know, the bad part of human nature at work. I don't know, but I see some influence from the Taint of Eridol and Padon Fain, but I really see a lot more of the direct machinations of Morden and Masana and some of the other Forsaken who are just trying to destroy the White Tower.
See, there's more to it, though, than just the different Ajahs at each other's throats and in these strange bloodlust. Because you also have examples of specifically, you have Barisine Sedai, who was one of the two reds in the carriage that had Egwene. She took Egwene's ring as a memento. That's wanton theft.
I could see both things at work, but I think that, yes, the Aes Sedai are in general good people, but it's like Moraine said in the very beginning when she's instructing Egwene while they're, you know, running from the Two Rivers to Barilon. She says Egwene wants to see Aes Sedai as good versus evil, and, you know, the male channelers are the bad ones who broke the world, and the White Tower are the good guys. And she said, but, you know, they're like any other community of people. There are good people. There are bad people. There are people who have this and not. And I think that's partly what's at work there. The Aes Sedai never took any oath not to steal. They never took any oath that they should be good people. They just swore the three oaths specifically, and that's it. And there are plenty of really obnoxious, selfish, self-aggrandizing Aes Sedai who stay within the confines of the three oaths, and that's been the case for 3,000 years. They have their own goals, they have their own agendas, they manipulate thrones, sometimes on the whim of the Amarlin Seed, sometimes on their own. I think that, you know, you get the bad eggs, and I think that some of these reds have always been bad eggs. Maybe not just reds. I'm sure there have been plenty of bad ones in all the Ajahs, but it just seems to me that the red has probably more than its share of rude, arrogant, obnoxious individuals, but and that just may be my perception of it.
Well, yeah, and I think part of a reason for that is those sisters who have become raised, who are already Dark Friends and are committed to helping the Dark Lord win, is they want to join the Red Aja so that when the time comes that the dragon is actually reborn, they could claim he was a liar and go and gentle him, and then no longer is he a threat to the Dark One. And that obviously that plan fell down around their heads quite quickly after Ren came about, but I think that might have been one of the original motivations for so many joining the Red Aja. Plus, we know that the leader of the Black was also the leader of the Red, and there has to be some connection between those two Aja that is major.
Oh, absolutely. And the Ajas actually came along, according to the Big White Book, somewhat later in time, you know, and they evolved over time. And we know that Ishamael was involved in creating the Black Aja. And there's, you know, there's absolutely nothing to say that he might not have had a hand in guiding the formation of some of the other Ajas to one extent or the other. And I have to agree with that one Aes Sedai whose name escapes me at the moment when I get into an argument with the other Aes Sedai. Well, if you want to find Dark Friends, look to the Reds. That's where you'll find them. You know, when somebody made a comment about Dark Friends in the White Tower, and that was their comeback. So, yeah, I think, you know, certainly having the head of your Aja be a Dark Friend is going to have a tendency to attract a lot more Dark Friends into the Reds. So that's probably why, if they haven't always been that way, they are now. And Dark Friends are not nice people. They don't play by the rules. They lie, they cheat, they steal. They've broken the three O's already because they've sworn others to the Black Aja. So, yeah, why wouldn't Barisine take her ring? Hey, what does she care? She's in power.
I only have a couple more points, actually, to make in Egwene's point of view. One thing I really wanted to do was break down Egwene's dream as she tells it to Sylveana. She says, "I dreamt of a glass lamp that burned with a white flame. Two ravens flew out of the mist, struck the lamp, and flew on. The lamp wobbled, flinging droplets of flaming oil. Some of those burned up in midair. Others lay scattered about, and the lamp still wobbled on the edge of falling." To break this down, the ravens hit the lamp and fly on. I always thought that was a little suspicious. Is the Shanshan attack that's coming not meant to subjugate the whole tower? I mean, it kind of implies that the attack is almost in passing. Now, maybe because Egwene didn't say that. You know, she says when you know what your dream means, you know what it means. But I just kind of have to wonder if maybe the attack is either interrupted or if it's, you know, if somehow the Shanshan forces get pulled away before they can completely destroy the tower. Some droplets burn up in midair. There's no real surprise to that. Not everyone is going to survive an attack by Shanshan, Sildam, and Damani. It's not going to happen. Others landed scattered about. Again, there's not really a huge surprise there. People are going to escape. They're going to flee, but they might not have a way to regroup. So we've so far got a devastating attack that may or may not be complete. We have people scattered all about, Aes Sedai all scattered about, and the lamp still wobbles. Again, it's not toppling, so the tower doesn't seem like it's going to be destroyed, but it's definitely going to be very, very weak. I just, for some reason, it seems like there's something that maybe Egwene's not completely getting as she analyzes this dream, and I don't know.
I put a little different interpretation on that. I think your first part of it, I agree with you. I think that the Seanchan meant to attack the White Tower and tear it down, but they were either interrupted or defeated by the Aes Sedai, or perhaps the intervention of the Dragon Reborn. Any number of things could happen to cause it to be an attack which does not destroy. So the lamp wobbling around, flinging off droplets of oil, I see those little droplets as not only being the Aes Sedai who don't survive, who do survive, and who are scattered around, but also all of these subgroups that Egwene is trying to bring into the White Tower, you know, the kin, the sea folk, you know, all of these secondary groups that she wants to be associated with the tower. I see some of those droplets of oil that scatter around but continue to burn as representing those other groups. And this whole thing is going to shake the White Tower. It's going to make it unstable. It's going to make it chaotic and everything, but it doesn't topple. It's not destroyed. And I think that as these groups, who are not necessarily in the White Tower, but came off from the White Tower, now associated with the White Tower, continue to grow and thrive, that eventually the tower will be made stronger and able to overcome, you know, the chaos that was sown by the Seanchan and by all these other different groups being integrated. That's just my interpretation of it. But I'm not a dreamer, so what do I know?
And here I am again with my dissenting opinion. I don't think that it refers to an actual strike force from the Seanchan, mostly because I don't think that they could get past Rand. Even if they do defeat him in Ilion, I don't think he'll let them get past and beyond there enough to get to Tarvalon and attack the White Tower. I've always thought of it more as referring to Matt coming to the White Tower. So if you think about it, the Band of the Red Hand now is as good as part of the Seanchan army. They're underneath the Prince of the Ravens. I don't know why I think that. I don't know what Matt coming to get the horn, which I assume is what he'd be doing there, Matt coming to get the horn, why that would have such a drastic effect on the White Tower. But I've just always had the feeling that that dream refers not to a Seanchan force, but to Matt, the Prince of the Ravens, coming to claim what he needs to claim.
That makes me think of that phrase that somebody said about them bringing Rand to the White Tower. The idea of having such a powerful Tavirin actually inside the White Tower was horrifying to them. I forgot who said that now.
Well, the last point I had wanted to make is a relatively minor one. As Egwene is led from Sylviana's study to her new novice room, she notices when she gets in that the lamp oil is smelling. I mean, it's rancid, it's gone bad. And that's an early nod towards a discussion that they end up having, that the keepings and the wards that they have set up with the One Power are failing. The world at this point, from the very beginning of the prologue, is moving steadily towards Tarmogoyf. The world is in trouble.
Hence, embers falling on dry grass.
Yeah. Well, you know, the world, the keepings are fading, the White Tower is noticing that the One Power, that Sidar, seems to be actually failing or going bad, and then later in the book, the whole world seems to ripple, and it looks like it's going to just, it feels like it's just going to dissolve into mist. You know, we've got the dead walking, we've got villages appearing out of nowhere and sinking back into the ground, you know, cats and dogs living together, you know, it's like, it's the end of the world as we know it. That's what's happening. Now, all these signs are just the harbingers of Tarmogoyf.
So I think that pretty much wraps up our discussion of the prologue and therefore this week's podcast. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in to listen. There are, of course, a number of ways that you can get a hold of us should you decide that we didn't go over something that you had caught, or if you have other ideas, if you have crazy theories, if something we said really sparked a good note or a bad note with you. There are a number of different ways to get a hold of us and let us know. You can, of course, leave us a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690.
And if you want to be like Spencer and just disagree with every single thing I said, I love you, Spencer, and I'm just kidding. No, it's cool. no, if you want to leave us an email, you can email us at podcast@dragonmount.com. and we do read every email. We usually respond to it relatively quickly, and we're always happy to do it. We frequently do, and they haven't all come through editing yet, but we have included a lot of listener emails in some of the episodes that are still sitting there waiting to be released. So email us. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, you know, this episode itself came from an email, an idea from a listener. But you can also contact us if you go to the podcast page on Dragonmount, www.dragonmount.com/podcast. You can leave a comment at the end of any of the podcasts. And there are a few of us that are always going through those and reading through them.
And commenting. There's also a podcast forum where you can chat with people and leave your comments. And then we are also on a number of the social media networks. We are on MySpace at www.myspace/fourthage. We're on Facebook. We have a fan group. You can be our friends on Facebook. Just search for Fourth Age. And you can also follow us on Twitter. Our username is at Fourth Age, all one word.
Also, I think we're going to post the list here that Andrew has compiled that we've been referencing all this night. We're going to post that onto the podcast forums on the Dragonmount website. Anyway, it's been good to talk to you tonight and to bounce ideas and theories off one another and to be the dissenting voice all night. Didn't even realize until just now that I was the dissenting voice all night. Anyway. It's really fun to kind of look through here and to realize that Robert Jordan has written such an amazing novel that we can sit for almost 4 hours just talking about little, tiny, minute points in only like 100 pages of text. So anyway, this is Spencer, and wishing that you may find water and shade.
And Spencer will not be back with us anymore because he's been nail-fired for disagreeing with me. No, I'm just kidding. I like it. Actually, it's more fun when we have dissension and disagreement. I think sometimes we're all on the same page too much, and it's good to have some back and forth and everything. So I'm happy that you did it. No, it's cool. Anyway, thank you, everybody, for listening to the episode. We really, really appreciate all of you. We love hearing from you. And until we meet again, may the light illumine you and bring you joy.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Shtharavyan into Manchima, Taishite. See, now that you've used that phrase, I can't help but think, it's the end of the world as we know it.
But I feel fine.
Because obviously I'm not a Nashimon.
Or even Lenny Bruce. Psycho killers. Ba, 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 ba. That's it. That's my thought.
Candygram.
Landshark.